Welcome to this very special Climatech edition of Great Minds. And with us is one of the real key players in the whole story of the evolution of Climatech. I think, Joe, it's fair to say, without you and Paul, this thing never happens. It's about to happen. We couldn't be more excited to have you. So with us today, a legend in the Boston area, Somerville in particular. We are thrilled to have with us the president of the Northeast Clean Energy Council, the great Joe Curtatone. So welcome, Joe.
Hey, Matt. Good morning. Thank you.
All right. Great to have you. So, Joe, you're a Massachusetts and a Boston area guy through and through, Somerville High School, university, including graduate degrees in the state. But there's one little entry on your history that stands out a little bit different from everything else. And that's a time you spent at Syracuse in aerospace engineering. And I thought that might be a fun place to start, a little bit different.
Wow, that's bringing back some memories. Yeah, that's right. So most people don't know unless they dig down like you have, Matt. I started at Boston College. I always had a dream as a young boy. I wanted to be a pilot. I wanted to be on planes. So I transferred after my junior year to Syracuse at Boston College. They had, at the time, no engineering program, particularly liberal arts. And I ended up at Syracuse. I ended up having to come back. My dad then became ill and I passed on. I came back, but it was some great memories. So I wanted to be around airplanes, so aerospace engineering, it's still something I, as a passion of mine, a dream of mine, even at my age. So some great memories in upstate New York.
Little tough winter up there.
Oh, yeah. You had that aggravating snow we say every weekend that come off the lake, but great times. And I still in my work now at the Northeast Clean Energy Council. A lot of memories came back because we also have a partnership as we represent out of New England and New York State with Syracuse University, the Dynamic Sustainability Lab, working with Jay Golden, an accomplished author as well in the clean energy space.
Yeah, and a great era in the Big East at that time. That was the real heyday of Big East basketball.
That was the heyday. I was at Boston College, by the way, and Doug Flutie was my freshman. He was a senior, wins the Heisman. 3 years at BC, I go to Syracuse. Syracuse goes undefeated with Derek McPherson as the coach. And then, of course, the basketball team, they just came off a national championship loss. It was the heyday of the Big East in terms of basketball. It was a great time. I'll tell you, I had a good time. So great people.
I grew up in Queens as a St. John's fan. And I remember that one year, I think it was 85, when in the Final Four, you had three out of the four teams were Big East. It was Villanova, which won, Georgetown, St. John's, and Memphis State. But those Syracuse teams, they used to break our hearts.
Yeah. Actually, yeah, it was great. It was Providence, St. John's, Syracuse. Those three. And who was it? I forget who the other fourth team was. Was it Memphis State? It might have been Memphis State, right? But it was some great, people don't realize the talent. You had Chris Mullen and Luke Kunasucker down at St. John's leading the charge. There were a lot of Boston and Massachusetts guys in there. Patrick Ewing, I would see as a kid down here. He next door in Cambridge, he'd come over to Somerville and play. He was the only 7-footer in the neighborhood. And the Villanova had a guy named Danny McLean and a kid from Wakefield, Mass. So a lot of, they were really mostly, so many of them were Northeast players, athletes, New York, Bay State. And it was a fascinating time, Pennsylvania area.
Yeah, they used to recruit locally and keep their players, which I think today, I don't know if it happens as much. All right, so moving on, Joe, you're such an interesting guy in so many places to take our conversation, but one of the things that's been a hallmark of your career has been a real commitment and passion for public service. I'd love to sort of dig a little deeper, Joe, and see, where did that come from? Does that come from your parents? Did that come from friends and teachers growing up? But that passion for public service is not within all of us. It clearly is front and center with you.
Yeah, you know what I like to refer to as my public service commitment or passion for it was unlocked. And I'll go back in the early 90s. I served locally in Somerville, first of all. Let me stop there. For 26 years, 8 years in the local legislative body, now the city council, and then 18 as mayor of Somerville from 2004 until 2022. Prior to that, my sister actually ran for mayor in the early 90s and lost. And it was so much about that campaign, which for me, I gained a negative perception of. And I was like, you know what? I don't want to be involved in politics and campaigning, but it's important to distinguish that from public service. But because then after, I remember a few years later, I then ran for the local legislative body. And what moved me was some of the things you've alluded to, you know, my family's work with seniors and the elderly. We were the administrators of a local elderly care facility or nursing home at the time. And I would spend, and even prior to that, for many years as a young boy, my mother and father were immigrants to this area from Italy. My mother would work as a cook and in the laundry in many nursing homes. And I would go visit as a young boy, and I'd spend times volunteering and doing activities, whether it's doing ice cream socials for them, bringing the senior men to the Red Sox games, you know, going with them, going to buy the tickets, and over again. And then there was also the impact people had on me, my teachers, my music teachers. I played several instruments growing up, my sports coaches. And so going back to what I mentioned earlier, my sister Rand was, I had a negative perception, but then things were happening around about politics, but it's important to distinguish politics from service. I was noticing things in my community where there was an alarming increase in youth violence. And I felt seniors in our community weren't getting enough services they need, you know, people who wanted to age in their older golden years in place in the community they love. So I said, you know, this is where we have impact on people in place through policy. And that motivated me and really unlocked my passion for public service. And that was 1995, and been nonstop since. And you come to understand public service has many different facets.
It sure does. So you start as an alderman, you end up an 18-year, give or take, run as mayor of Somerville, going back, as you said, to 2004. Talk about the job on day one and memories of that very first time you sat behind the mayor's desk in Somerville, your emotional state, your vision. And Somerville was a pretty tough place at that time. Talk about what you found on day one, but let's go back to those first memories of, you know, the very first morning, the very first day as mayor of Somerville.
Yeah, I actually remember it clearly. You know, we campaigned uncertain about really elevating Somerville, its narrative, but it's, you know, really trying to inspire a collective goal and vision for a community to be the standard for city services, for creating opportunity for everyone in your community. And also we had a negative, you probably saw this in any research, we had a negative reputation. We were still known even in those days as Slummerville, because I always tell everyone, by the way, Somerville is the quote unquote, since you're a New York guy, the Brooklyn of Boston, because we were located in sort of the makeup geographically and demographically in the city and that sort of connectiveness and creativity of it. But we couldn't get out of our own way for many, many decades. And I remember telling folks in different settings as I was running, if you don't like that reputation, we'll own it and change it. Put a stake in the ground that we're going to be the most exceptional place to live, work, play, raise a family, you know. And we wanted to unlock Somerville as a test lab for innovation. And so walking into office that first day, you know, you have all these ideas and you walk into the mayor's office, you're like, hey, what the hell do we do now? And it's kind of like, you know, in the work, in the area I'm in now, and you places like Greentown Lab, you want to surround yourself with people with a passion for curiosity, a willingness to be abnormal and create that bump factor. You know, you put creative minds in an arena and a place and just let them go. And that's what we sought out to do. And there was really no algorithm to that. You know, what you wanted to do is take off the boundaries and just ask why, be probative, you know, how do we do this? How do we improve that? Unlocked in. But to also have an important message about, you know, as I mentioned, what is the value or the mission, a set of values that orients all our work, not just as an administration, but the community at large. So not knowing where it was going to take us, we had all the hopes and dreams. That's what it was like the first day. Like, okay, how do we get this going? Because you get in there, you start to see things. Things are tougher than you actually realized or perceived.
And talk about that moment where you had sort of a first success. It might have been small, it might have been large, but where there was a little victory that had to give you, even as a confident person, had to give you a little extra jolt of confidence that, hey, I think we can really make this thing work here.
Yeah, actually, the first thing, you look for those victories, right? Right off the bat, you want to create momentum. And I'll tell you a funny story, and this was well publicized. The first big moment wasn't even a victory. Really, I would say it was a botched snow emergency in the Boston area. And one of the first victories we wanted to have is, and I'll give you the setting, a month before I took office, December 6th, 2003, there was a massive snowstorm. It might have hit New York as well, but in the Northeast. And I had been elected, but not been sworn in, so we're in transition. there was a lot of news coverage about the lack of response to removing snow and vehicles and around this area. And in Boston, in fact, first responders couldn't get to a person in need and that person passed away. Some of them do a lot of complaints. So we swore we'd get in, we're going to fix that right off the bat. We had this plan and to communicate. And by the way, there were no reverse forms of communication. We weren't doing the electronic forms of bilateral forms of communication. We weren't even evolving them. So we had the bullhorns on the police cruisers going around. We were putting flyers on cars and so forth and said, we're going to enforce parking. You can't park on this side of the street and so forth. And when it snows, we're going to tow. We're going to promise the public that those streets clean. First storm comes and we're all excited. This is going to be our first victory. We're just rubbing our hands together. We're going to show them. Cut the story short here. It was supposed to be a massive storm of 12 inches of snow or something like that. And as the night goes forward, they say, well, it's going to come down 6 inches, so forth. Our policy was going to be anything over 4 inches, not a speck of snow on the ground. We towed over 700 cars. And this is like a borough of New York stuff, 700 cars. We tagged over 2,200 cars with tickets. And even though some of them, we were probably getting the second most media in my tenure outside the city of Boston itself. At that time, and that now it's gone away, you had one paper that came out weekly. So when something bad happened, you couldn't get it. And then the news story the next day, but the globe was all over me, all the enforcement and no snow. Meanwhile, the meteorologist got off scot-free. The thing about it is the victory on that was that everybody did move their cars every snowstorm from that point forward. They feared we would tell them. So that's a funny story. That was an interesting learning moment. One of the, I think the things I look back on that victory that gave us sort of traction and say we could do it. It's hard to point on one thing. I would say the big one was probably months later. There's a big project in Somerville called Assembly Row, which is a neighborhood, probably the exciting newest neighborhood in the Eastern Seaboard. And it was in the litigation, a massive redevelopment of an urban former industrial site here in Somerville. And Somerville's only 4.1 square miles on the Mystic River. And we're stuck in litigation. We couldn't get zoning passed. We couldn't get the rules down. We had billions of dollars pent up for investment, ready to be unlocked. And over many, many months of working, engaging the community civically, aligning allies and stakeholders, we were able to resolve all the litigation and unlock really more than $1.5 billion of investment back then, almost 20 years ago. And if you come to Somerville and you go to Assembly Row, you see that neighborhood, it was just industrial wasteland. So I think that was a big victory about, being persistent, being engaged, bringing all voices to the table, dreaming big and being relentless in pursuing your dreams as a community. That was something that really motivated us. And along the way, though, there were a lot of other things every day that don't get heralded. You don't get talked about that. That's one that really sticks out in my mind in that first year.
Great, great stuff. I love how the meteorologists do, in fact, get off scot-free.
They do every time.
Amazing. So you used the word innovation earlier, and your tenure as mayor really coincided with the birth of the digital age. You mentioned how going back to communication, that early botched snowstorm story, you could only do it the old way, right? Bullhorns, putting flyers on people's cars, putting signs in windows of local retailers. But then along comes the internet, along comes the iPhone in 2006, YouTube in 2007, all the technology that dominates today, the rise of the mobile phone as literally a computer in your pocket. Talk about the role that technology played and how you integrated and embraced technology and really brought that notion of innovation to life in Somerville.
Yeah, it's amazing. As you talk about it, how quick things, how fast they evolve. So we take office in January 2004. Most of the staff didn't even have email set up. I was using, eventually I went to a BlackBerry, and obviously for those who don't remember BlackBerry phone, that was big. I was using a two-way Motorola to communicate the flip phones with some of our staff, and that was big. You come to understand, as a public official, we took pride as an administration in embracing the notion that there's no such thing as over-redundancy in terms of finding ways and modes to connect with your population, the people you serve. We see that continue evolve today, especially in the younger generation, how we retail, how we consume information or seek it out comes from many different forms. So we saw that evolving quickly. So we embraced and sought out every mode of communication, not just to engage our public, but as an important source of deriving data We were one of the first and only cities in the nation to establish an analytics platform and division in Somerville called Somerstat. And data for us was important, not just the number of potholes we filled or how much graffiti we moved or service calls, but just understanding the questions of how information people were seeking. That was important for us to give us guidance and compass to understand if our policies are having an impact or if we were fully in touch with the populace. So, one, we pride ourselves, we opened up Somerville as a test lab for innovation and ideas with partnerships with academic institutions like the Harvard Kennedy School and eventually down the road with Greentown Labs. But the greatest guidance on how the city was evolving and the innovative opportunity, the creativity of it was from opening up the door on our lens that there are many more forms of communication beyond texting or the 311 call system we put in. Or emails. We didn't even have a really good website at the time. So we embraced, the different conduits to people's voices and their ears, as you mentioned, whether it be YouTube and eventually down the road, even TikTok. We sought it out and we couldn't get enough of it.
Well, it's an incredible success story. And, I love the dynamic, almost a competitive dynamic between Boston proper and Somerville. And I think there's a real little, let's call it a rivalry there.
Oh yeah, we loved kicking Boston's ass. I joke now with the current mayor, and she knows she was a city councilor, and we knew Boston. This again, so if people don't know, I'm sure many people have been to this area, and if this was New York Metro, we would actually be Brooklyn or something of that. What I mean, everything is parochial here, and so aren't the rivalries. Somerville was part of Charlestown until the late 1800s. We really bleed into the neighborhoods, and I would say, hey, I live closer to Boston City Hall than any mayor of Boston, and that was true. And we took pride in that. We also took pride in the fact that transforming from where we were, we couldn't attract any talent to work for us. That everybody wanted to work in Somerville because we just gave them license to be. To again unlock that passion for curiosity, to be abnormal, to take risks. And those risks were based on reason. And we knew, when I started off, it was tough. Could we get this person to come work for us? Or they were going to work for Boston or Cambridge. Eventually, they wanted to all go to Somerville. And we also knew from good intelligence that Boston was on our website every day seeking out what we're doing. So it was a really good rivalry. And I always still joke with every once in a while with the current mayor, Mayor Wu, who's doing a great job. We took pride in it because again, we had that reputation. We were Somerville to some people in Boston, and that was no more. So yeah, that was great stuff, and that was always a point of joy for the community.
Terrific stuff. So you talk about coming from an immigrant family. I do as well. My grandfather came through Ellis Island many years ago. I guess you're second generation here.
Right. I was born here. My parents were both married in a place called Gaeta, Italy.
And Joe, there is a certain work ethic I find for people that are first, second, third, even fourth generation immigrants. And when you sort of combine that Somerville spirit and that immigrant work ethic, that's an awfully potent 1-2 punch.
Yeah, I agree. And that is so much, you mentioned, asked earlier, what motivated or inspired you to run. It's that experience as well, the immigrant experience. That's a big part of it for me. I grew up in a neighborhood where every one of my neighbors, they either came from, at that time, Italy, Ireland, Portugal, mostly the San Miguel and the Azores or Greece. And our families worked in the same factories and or in the same areas we were, Somerville, by the way, is the most densely populated city in New England. If you wanted to meet your neighbor, just reach out your window, you're in their kitchen. That we all played and ran free range in the streets. We experienced each other's cultures, recipes, and experiences. Again, we might have had that reputation, that name that branding experts asked me not to repeat, but what makes cities great is that social thread, that social connectedness. It makes them innovative as well. Today is no different. We speak more than 52 languages, but that immigrant experience certainly inspired me about how we create equitable opportunities for everyone to participate in the American experience and the American dream. It was important for my family. My first language was Italian, because my parents didn't speak English. And luckily, I spoke English faster than my sister did. She struggled, even though she's very successful today as a young child, because she only knew how to speak Italian. She taught me English when we were kids. So it's big for me, and I'm sure it is for you and anyone who has that experience can speak to that.
Absolutely. And when we're at our best, it's all those attributes, as Americans that you mentioned. So as we start to weave our way towards climate tech, I'm going to guess that the story of Greentown Labs in Somerville was a pretty big development moment in time happening now, an incredibly powerful engine with global impact. But can we talk a little bit about Greentown Labs?
Absolutely. And that's an interesting story. It's been a little over a decade now since my administration became introduced to or came across the folks from Greentown Labs. And at the time, they were in South Boston on the waterfront. They originally had started in Cambridge, and they were on South Boston in this really sort of musty, dingy old industrial site. And there were 25 climate tech startup companies in Greentown at the time. They were led by this inspiring, innovative leader, Emily Reichert. And I remember clearly when the folks in my administration and in the Office of Strategic Planning Community Development, my director there, Mike Glavin, had said to me, "Hey, we need to meet these folks." And just to set the stage, we were coming probably in the just coming out of the depths of the Great Recession. Somerville has seen a lot of success even late leading into the recession, and we were taking. Setting the stage, when things are down, that's when you double down about moving forward. And that's when you get even more disciplined about not selling short. We as a community knew where we wanted to go. We wanted to seize the moment to have control in the long term for our fiscal stability and providing the services we wanted for our constituents. And also, we wanted to set the platform and the table for new industries and the next great thing. And we knew climate tech was that at the time. And we were also in. Because we are next to the life sciences hub of the globe here in Kendall Square, setting the table for that. But we knew clean energy, clean tech at the time, or climate tech would be that. So when we met, and I got the chance to go down to South Boston and meet Emily Reichert, the first question I had is part of my passion and curiosity, what are you doing here? Just curious, how do you, and we would have those questions all the time. And in this context, entrepreneurs, why do they want to be here? What do they need? What do they look for? Interestingly enough, many of those climate tech startups had in their organizations were founded by folks around Somerville and Cambridge. So we had a site, and let me do some follow-up questions. We had a site in Somerville, which was a former paper or envelope factory called the AIM Safety Envelope Site. And you and I, old enough, Matt, when we used to go to the doctor's office, those color-coded medical files, they used to make them there. But you know, even though you and I are still fans, that went away with bell bottoms and the Bee Gees around that time, and everything was going digital, you know, electronic documents. But there was a 7-acre former industrial site that held this opportunity. And we wanted to get Greentown into Somerville. And we had a building. And I happened to find at the time, this is still in the throes of the Great Recession coming out of it. We gave them $1 million that we had in our banks. It was, say, some old federal funding for economic development that was applicable to bring a Greentown over to for job creation and so forth. So and Greentown was able to leverage that and come to Somerville. And we'll talk about this and the rest is history.
And today, all these years later, so I guess you're going back to the recession, that was 2008, 2009, around that time. Today, Greentown Labs out of Somerville, and I think they have another one in Houston, but the mothership is in Somerville, tremendous player globally in that intersection of the climate crisis and tech.
Give everyone listening context and great about the scale and the velocity, how fast they grew. Greentown in Somerville opened 2013, so it was a couple of years before that, you know, a few years before that, coming out of the recession. But from those first couple of years in Somerville, when they opened up in the first building in the former AIM Safety Envelope site, they grew from the 24 to the 25 climate tech startup companies that came over. So from 24 to over 70 in less than 3 years, and they were quickly at capacity. And so within that time, within just a few years, we were already speaking to now, if people have, if you haven't been to Greentown, there's two buildings. The front building, another old foundry building, which is a former glass factory from generations ago, where immigrants from the community and even my family's hometown worked. That was at that time a Maaco auto body. And we were able to work with the property owner, a different owner, to consider and eventually agree to lease the property Greentown and quickly expanded this. So, as you have mentioned, from that time period, I believe from the official opening in 2013 to where we are today, Greentown Lab and Somerville houses more than 160 climate tech startup companies, probably just short of 100 in Houston. I participated in that virtual celebration with former mayor of Houston, Turner. And now that represents the largest climate tech incubator in North America. And in Somerville, we'd say the portal to the global climate economy, and right here in the greater Boston area.
It's a tremendous story, and it really weaves us to how and why climate tech is happening at all, and why it's happening in Massachusetts. You're not the only one, clearly one of the leaders, but you mentioned Emily, who will be speaking at Climate Tech. So many other leaders there, whether by purpose, design, accident, or a little bit of all three, Massachusetts really has become the global hub of that intersection of climate and technology. And all credit to people like Governor Healey and Secretary Howe and so many others for seizing that economic development opportunity. Economic development was really at the heart of what you were doing as mayor of Somerville back then.
All right, and that's an important point, Matt. You're mentioning climate action. The climate crisis is real. And what allured me after leaving as mayor of Somerville to this work is that inextricable link between the urgent need to take climate action, but also the incredible, I think, historic opportunity to forge that next industrial revolution, the green industrial revolution. The two are tied together. The opportunity to have impact on people, place, and planet, and if we do it right, create genuine opportunities to participate in this economy. I think people need to remember, I mentioned the life sciences economy here. Not everyone has an opportunity to participate in that. We're not only going to get the chance to be on par and surpass the life sciences economic impact in terms of the companies that are forged and established, but the individual, the people who get to work their jobs, those who've been left behind, it typically have been poor communities, Black, Brown, the BIPOC community, women, and here's an opportunity to do that. So that allured me, and it is an economic impact will be could be unmatched here. And we've seen that really take have increased velocity with the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act, which really unlocked an incredible amount of private sector investment. And we're seeing with leadership in many states. And look, I'll give a shout out to New York State as well. Let's give a big shout out to New York State and organization I started. But here in Massachusetts, certainly Governor Healey and her administration, an incredible job. And now Emily Reichert, Dr. Reichert, leads the Massachusetts Clean Energy Center, MassEEC, which is sort of the, on par with NYSERDA for Massachusetts. But the point is, I'll just end with this, if you did an oval shape between Boston Metro and New York Metro, that and the Northeast region is really that hotbed of private sector climate tech investment. But if you looked at New York Metro versus Boston Metro from 2018 to 2023, New York Metro saw really an impressive about approximately $7.4 billion of private sector investment in climate tech. Greater Boston Metro, $10.1 billion. I think, when we think about the Northeast, we're really in the epicenter here.
Yeah. And going back to some of the early conversations that we had about the Climate Tech Project, if you go back in history and you look at, the scions who built Hollywood, Fox was a William Fox. The Warner Brothers were Jack and the Warner Brothers. And there was a vision for production, for film and then television that made Hollywood and Los Angeles what it is globally. You see that same vision here for Boston and areas like Somerville, not just for the Northeast, but with that same level of global impact.
Absolutely. The investment piece is huge, but when you see commitments from on the public policy side to, it reminds me of what we did in Somerville to open up the Commonwealth of Massachusetts and every region as a test lab for climate tech innovation. That's big. Entrepreneurs, they need to know, understand they're chasing world-changing technology to help us meet our climate action goals and deal with the climate crisis. We're assisting them accelerating and educating how to build a company and get investment. They need investment. They also need, a big need is to be able to test and pilot their ideas and to go to regions or parts or states that welcome this industry and embracing it, not just helping them site their companies or test their technologies, but to invest or develop policies and regulations to accelerate those technologies to market. Massachusetts, especially under the Governor Healey's administration, and I really put a big bet in the ground with the recent proposal of the Mass Leads Act of $1 billion over the next 10 years towards climate tech and one accelerating those technologies, the emerging those companies, also keeping companies in the region. So I think that's really exciting and really is important backdrop to the Climate Tech Summit next week.
Well, what's been rewarding to watch from the outside as the token New Yorker in the project, it really brought me back to my early career, Joe. I worked for a great mayor in New York, Ed Koch, back in the 80s. And that was the aftermath of the LA Olympic Games, which really created in many, many ways the modern sports marketing business. And it was a combination of things that out of necessity, Peter Ueberroth, a hero of mine and a mentor, and the late Harry Usher, they created a games that had to be profitable because they had no other money. Tom Bradley said, you can have the games in LA, but we don't have any money. Governor Reagan said, you can have the games in California, but we don't have any money. And neither the U.S. Olympic Committee or the IOC had any money. And they developed a strategy really to wrap American brands around the American flag, staged at a tremendous games, ended up with a surplus of $225 million, which was a lot of money in those days. And there was sort of an epiphany around the country that paying attention to sports as economic development was good policy. And New York City decided to create something called the New York City Sports Commission. And because it was not a priority of Mayor Koch, I, as a 23-year-old kid, got the job as executive director. And there are things that we did there simply because there was a commitment and a focus that are still here today. I mean, we started November of 87. There's an Olympic Aquatic Center about 10 miles from my house, probably less, that's still there today that young kids are swimming in right now that we built for an event that we brought into New York called the Goodwill Games. The ability of policymakers to have an impact on an area with a commitment and a focus from leadership is something that all too often in American politics we've gotten away from. Certainly at the federal level, where there's just all kinds of, you know, paralysis and acrimony. What you're seeing in Boston and Massachusetts is a real testimony to what public leadership can do. And it's been a real joy to watch it all unfold, working with my partner in crime here, Paul Scapicchio, and yourself and so many others. And it really gives you a sense of what's possible.
Yeah, and I think you hit it. And first of all, I knew I liked something about you, Matt. You worked for a mayor and a city. Now I understand the synergy here. And you bring back some memories. And I do believe, by the way, being a high school senior at the time, the 84 games were the best ever. In terms of production, and Peter Ueberroth is a legend, right? In so many ways, a visionary. But you're right. In politics, I wonder, and to me, I'm baffled. Even some of the leaders I have the most admiration for, do they realize what they can inspire? Not just by your words. And some of it isn't really earth-shattering, just the things you can unlock. And as you're describing that, I'm going back to, as we're speaking to Greentown about coming to Summer Bowl, they wanted to be, you know, the narrative, the messaging, what we were saying, what we were doing, even if we didn't have the money to do all those things, that we were all in. People want to be part of a winning proposition, that we're all in to take on climate action, that we're all in to unlock and be a leader in this green industrial revolution. And whether a policy we propose now that is important that doesn't pass, that we are going to be relentless, tenacious, and chasing that inspires others to want to be around you, side by side with you. So as you mentioned that in the sports analogy, I couldn't agree more. Somerville, in my tenure, I mean, we didn't have two nickels to scratch together, create a dime. And so we left the millions in net new growth and opportunity money. But what made people want to come to Somerville was this idea, the values that oriented all our work together in this belief that we were going to chase this and that we were not going to deviate from where we were going. This was too important. And when you connect values to that commitment, special things happen. It's that bump factor, right? It's the Greentown scenario. So I couldn't agree more. And I appreciate you reminding me that, because I just feel sometimes our elected leaders, even the ones I have the most respect for, have got the blinders on too much from that view. And I wish they could see beyond the very important, albeit important, but narrow things they're focused on, that there's so much opportunity before us. It's not difficult to achieve. We just have to be committed.
Well, you know, I remember going back now, you know, the three legs of our stool were always economic development, quality of life, and image. And when you hit it right, you uplift on all three. And that little stool becomes a much bigger stool that a lot of people can sit on.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned image. People, I would butt heads with folks all the time about why are we focused on communications as elected officials, branding and image, you know, that's not important. It is very important because it's about communicating with everybody. And if you put in the context of where Somerville was, we were known as Slumerville, you know, and I said, if you don't like that word, put it to death and never say it again. And this is where we're going to be. We are the best for this. We are that. And if you don't think we are, then challenge us, bring it on. And, you know, and that's important because it does uplift people. It does inspire them. Like, I want to do my part to those values of the community, you know, whether, no matter who I am, whether I'm elected official, whether I'm an activist or advocate, whether I'm a student, whether I own a small business, just give a damn about the community that I love. That's important that the work we're doing now and around climate tech. You know, I remember being upon taking this position I have now at the Northeast Clean Energy Council. I went over to COP over in Glasgow. And I remember former President Obama mentioned, we don't have a unified human narrative to uplift people. And that's important. So to me, when we speak image, communication, engagement, messaging, in any successful endeavor, you know this, it's an important piece of it.
Absolutely. And years ago, we worked on a wonderful project in Newark. There's a very, very successful guy, Ray Chambers. He was partners with William E. Simon, the former Secretary of the Treasurer, Wes Ray. Ray was the Ray and Wes Ray. That was their company. And Ray had a vision for his hometown of Newark, which had a similar reputation to Somerville when you took it over. And they built the New Jersey Performing Arts Center and JPAC. They built the arena in downtown Newark, and they really changed that place. And companies started to move back to downtown Newark after abandoning it. And it's clear, you know, the impact that you can make, and you certainly have made, Joe. So we'd be remiss not to talk about our friend Paul and sort of the origins of climate tech. It will take off next week in Boston. We are thrilled to be having our opening night at the St. Paul's Cathedral or the Sydney Opera House of Boston, Fenway Park. We've got a wonderful night where Emily will be on the program at the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library next Tuesday night. But I'd love to talk about the origin of your relationship with Paul and sort of the earliest conversations around what would become climate tech, which predated our arrival on the project.
Sure. I don't know if you even know this, Matt. Paul and I have known each other since 1985. We used to work out at the same gym. I was the only one, I think, for heavy lifting here, at least to train together. But we became friends then, and we had some parallel career paths. He was serving on the Boston City Council, and I was serving on the Board of Aldermen, and Somerville, now they call the City Council, then eventually mayor. So we crossed paths. We were both at 10 different convenings at the Harvard Kennedy School, and we still remain friends and engage in different projects together. And to bring us fast forward to how we climate tech and eventually connecting with your leadership and where it came to be. And we were working and helping one of my member companies, Spark Charge. Spark Charge is led by an incredibly talented CEO, Josh Aviv. He founded his company and technology in his dorm room at Syracuse University, actually in 2014, the world's first mobile EV charging battery unit on demand. He eventually won Shark Tank, came to Greentown Labs, came through our accelerator at the Northeast Clean Energy Council and his headquarters in that short time period, less than 10 years, several years. His headquarters now is here in Somerville in Assembly Row, and his manufacturing site is out in Buffalo, New York. And he had an event called Spark Day. It's a micro version of, let's just say Spark Day, kind of a very micro version of climate tech, what we're thinking of, a focus solely on, we're doing on the EV charging and so forth. And he held it at Assembly Row. And Paul and I assisted him. I did in my trade organization. Paul was giving him some consultancy work. And then Josh Aviv, well, I just had a conversation with him yesterday. We're just reminiscing in that short time. Talked about, you know, this, what we're doing here really should be something much bigger. You know, this should be sort of a South by Southwest up here in Boston. Boston Metro has so much to offer. You're at the epicenter, the portal to the global climate economy. The climate tech innovation is world leading here. And that really just sparked our imagination. So for more than a year and a half, Paul Skopicki and I, working alongside Josh, really started to put the pieces in place of how we would pull this off. we wanted to make sure we, and meeting you was really interesting and fortuitous because we thought we shared the same thoughts. We wanted to be experiential, not to be typical, and the venues to be unique and take advantage of the cultural scene, the music scene, the creative scene ecosystem that's in this area, from arts to technology, and so the value set. And that led us to many, many months of engagement with the Healy, Governor Healy's administration, Mayor Wu in the city of Boston, and many, many other stakeholders and partners in the climate action, clean energy and climate tech ecosystem. And then, thank God, in a conversation with you. Here we are.
It's been an absolute labor of love. Paul and I have become really close. And I think when we were first introduced, I think it's fair to say neither one of us necessarily wanted to have a partner. And it was at the behest of the state, and they were right. It was a great instinct that Secretary Howe and Undersecretary Ashley Stolba had. And Paul and I have become really close. I think our skill sets have been really complementary. And I think Boston, and you know this, Joe, it's an old school town. It helps to have somebody who really knows how to get business done in Boston. It's a unique place. I love Boston. My daughter went to Boston University, so it's been a joy to get to come back and spend more time there. No one believes me, Joe. They will think I'm making it up and pandering, but I actually was a big fan of the 70s Red Sox teams. My wife and I both went to camp in New Hampshire, and that era of, you know, Freddie Lynn and Center and Jim Rice and Carl Yastrzemski, and, you know, absolutely love those teams. Love the old ballparks, the only two we have left, Fenway and Wrigley. We have gotten to go to Fenway a bunch over the years. And it's an absolute joy to have gotten to know you, Joe, the work that you do. Paul had me as his guest at the Northeast Clean Energy Council annual gala last fall. Very impressive gathering and group that you lead. And I think it's a testimony to great leadership, and that let's remember that great leaders have an ability to move the needle on important issues. And that's certainly what is happening in the Commonwealth around that intersection of the climate crisis and technology.
I thought you were going to mention that you love the Red Sox because the Yankees break our hearts so many times in those days. Those are tough days, but those are great battles.
I am a Yankee fan. But I did love, and the truth is, people, this is a story probably not worth telling, but I grew up in Queens as a Met fan. My family was all from Brooklyn. And we had a dispute, ironically, over the Goodwill Games way back when with Fred Wilpon. And he was out of line about an issue and got on the phone and gave me an earful. And I was like, whoa, 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 you're all wrong. That's not what happened. Here's what did happen, and we will fix it and honor a particular promise that was made. It was actually to pay for a plane that brought then Governor Mario Cuomo to St. Petersburg, Russia, for the closing ceremony of the 94 Goodwill Games. It ended up being in a small room. I was about 30 years old, and it was myself, Ted Turner, Boris Yeltsin, and Mario Cuomo all in a room together. And Steinbrenner, Steinbrenner, who was an irascible, real son of a bitch, you know, but a tough, tough guy. George loved me. And so I switched to the Yankees because I didn't like that Wilpon yelled at me and that Steinbrenner. And but back in the 70s, going all the way back, I did love those Red Sox teams with, you know, Carlton Fisk and Butch Hobson and George Scott and all those great, great players. Yes, the Yankees have gotten the better of you, but you've won, I think, four trophies.
Let me come around.
You're doing okay. We're thrilled to be at Fenway next Monday night. So, Joe, I can't thank you enough for doing this. An absolute joy to get to talk to you. This very special Climate Tech edition of Great Minds. We'll post a bunch of them over the next few weeks, pre and post. And looking forward to a great success in Boston next week.
I think it's going to be great. I just want to end saying, you know, you brought up a good point. You know, the purpose of this, we're getting together, not just to get together. The message we're going to amplify here and at Climate Tech and moving forward, it will resonate globally of what is possible, what is being done. And, you know, and I'm confident it will inspire more work and engagement and from our policy leaders as well. So thanks for your leadership, Matt. And look forward to seeing everyone here in Boston, June 3rd, 4th, and 5th, and Climate Tech launches. And we look forward to seeing you around the globe in the years to come.
Fantastic, Joe. Thanks so much. Have a great day.
You too. Take care.